Hey, Samantha, where can they find us on the social medias?
I am so glad you asked. They can find us on Facebook and Instagram at Reaper Tales Podcast and on TikTok at reaper.tales.podc. Not pod, just podc.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you can email us at reapergals@reapertales.com. I'm always looking at it. So if you're one of the ones that emails me on a regular basis, you know that. I do respond almost in real time, unless like
almost.
I'm on vacation or like I'm bed rotting, but that's a different thing. So email us at reapergals, G-A-L-S, at reapertales.com. Email me to tell me that I look pretty. Email me to tell me I'm doing a good job and to send us your show suggestions and anything else that you want us to cover or anything like that. So, yeah.
And please remember to like, rate, review, subscribe, all the things you lovely listeners know what to do anyway on any of the listening platforms that you use. As per usual, you get bonus points if you do it on platforms you don't listen to us on, but you give us a nice little review. And worded reviews will get special shout outs. So if you are so inclined to do so, please do us a favor. Makes it a little easier for people to find us. And if you don't
Thanks.
Want to be listed out, by the way, on the worded reviews, it's too bad. We're still going to give you a shout out.
Yeah. Yeah. Even if you say we smell like boogers or something like that. Okay. Thanks.
Rude.
Hello. I'm Montana.
And I'm Samantha.
And you're listening to
Reaper Tales. And today I'm going to tell all of you lovely listeners in Montana about the history of the circus, which they found out about 5 minutes ago what I was covering.
Sure did.
But
I
before
guessed
we
it.
You did guess it after you saw the drink. So what are we pairing? What drink are we pairing with this episode, Montana? Because we're not actually
okay.
drinking it because it's a little early.
Yeah, it's real early, so we're not drinking. We are not drinking, but we might. Actually, I'm not drinking this because this might send me to an early grave.
This is meant to be shared.
This is
over a course of time.
Yeah. It's called the Cotton Candy Cocktail. Here you go, guys. Don't follow this recipe to a T, I would suggest, or do. It's up to you. You know,
we can't
whatever.
Tell you what to do.
But it says that you need one large bag of cotton candy, any flavor. I would suggest the pink one.
It's
just
pretty.
I bet it would look good. And one bottle of marshmallow vodka, the whole bottle, and one bottle of sparkling water. I don't know if that's a 12 ounce. I don't know if that's a 2 liter. Not sure. Measure with your heart.
I mean, the instructions are... they do label it out. You aren't pouring a whole bottle in. It's
right. So it says, fill a glass with fluffy cotton candy and place them on a serving tray. Pour 1 ounce or 2 tablespoons of vodka over the cotton candy and top with sparkling water and add ice. Cotton candy will melt immediately and sweeten the cocktail to taste like, well, cotton candy. Garnish with cotton candy. Drink stick. Whatever.
It really looks pretty.
It does look pretty, but this recipe is wild because with those ingredients, it says it makes 2 servings. So if you want to risk it, you know, follow
that
recipe.
I'm hoping you're using a small bottle of vodka.
Yeah.
Please. Yeah. For all of our sakes. And don't be drinking this while driving. Only if you're at home.
Right.
Listening to this
only
episode.
Only if you're at home. And according to Kelsey, we have an audience and we don't want, you know, any of you to go.
An audience.
We have an audience. Yikes.
Well, to all of our listeners, we do love you and we're glad you're here. And are you, Montana, you ready to hear about the circus?
Yes. I've never been to a circus. So, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
So... I've only been once, and it was right after we moved to Alabama. Birmingham had the Ringling Brothers Circus came to town at the BJCC, I think it was. And it's the only time I can remember them being here, but they had to have been here multiple times after that. But it was wild, to say the least. But
yeah, my mom wouldn't let us go.
I remember it because I remember cotton candy, and that was like one of the first times I'd ever seen cotton candy.
Oh, yeah. Well, we couldn't go because my mom was like, it's not ethical to go, blah, blah, blah. Which, you know, true, but I did read a book in the past couple of years about the circus, so I know a little bit, but I don't remember a lot of it. Thanks, ADHD. You make rereading things very fun.
Yeah, fair. Paul can watch the same movie 5 times, and it's just like the first every time. Unless it's the Fast and the Furious movies, that those he actually remembers.
He's a cool guy. I like hanging out with him because I don't have to say anything and he doesn't say anything. It's very quiet.
It's not awkward at all.
Nope.
Well, I will tell you that I'm going to cover kind of a broad history of the circus. So I wanted to cover something different. We had been talking after the last episode that Montana did, and I was like, we wanted to do something a little bit lighter. And one of my favorite movies is The Greatest Showman. And I've often watched that movie and wondered how, because anytime you watch those movies, you're like, how much of this is true? How much of this is completely fabricated? How much is it kind of close to the truth, but also we took some liberties. And I just happened to think about it.
Maybe.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you, Kelsey. I agree. But I just happened to think about it. I was like, well, how about I cover this and do kind of like Montana does with the Pirates thing and just kind of follow this theme every so often. So I'll trickle in some different episodes over, I don't know, the next year or something. It'll be a good like break from the Black Widows, which I have more than enough material to keep me occupied for the next 2 years if I did one every month. And it's a little bit probably more on the lighthearted side, although there are definitely some dark aspects to it that I would like to get into as well. So wanted to do a brief history of it just so that we kind of know where it came from, and then we'll go from there.
Aye, aye, Captain.
Whatever. While some of the history is hard to nail down, most people agree that the modern circus started in the 18th century, and this makes sense in a lot of ways. I guess it depends on your definition of a circus. Many people believe the first actual circus would have been in ancient Rome. Think about it. The stage battles, horse and chariot races, gladiator battles, and trained animals. Sounds a lot like a circus. What I found interesting was that at that time, the circus was the only exhibition that could be attended with men and women together. Any other performances that they went to would separate the men from the women.
I bet they had some dope snacks, too. Rome back in the day? Hell yeah.
Somehow I don't think they tasted good. I don't think anything tasted good. Everybody was dirty. Nobody bathed. I don't have a lot of faith there. But
yeah,
maybe.
But cheese, you know, grapes. What Kelsey just ate?
You had to be pretty darn rich to have that kind of stuff, I think. Peons
they didn't have
that
any
were
hot
attending.
Dogs.
No hot dogs. Probably not.
No peanuts.
They had their version, which I hate to know what that was made out of.
Gross.
Per historyofcircus.com, quote, the earliest circus in Rome was the Circus Maximus, built in the Old Kingdom era. When finished, it could receive 250,000 people and was 400 meters long and 90 meters wide. Circus Flaminus, Circus Neronus, and Circus Maxentius are other famous circuses of the Roman era. So I don't know that those were actually called circus at the time because, as I'll get to later, circus wasn't a term that was really used. But that's at least what it was called in the history book. So I think I'm thinking they went back and renamed them that. But anyway. The modern circus, the one we know best, began in the 18th century by a cavalry officer from England named Philip Astley. He's actually known as the father of the modern circus. On April 4th, 1768, he and his wife Patty opened an amphitheater in Lambeth, London, to display horse riding tricks and train others in horseback riding, as both Philip and Patty were expert riders.
Samantha, you missed an opportunity to name yourself Philip on this episode. I'm sad.
Okay. There's one person in this trio that renames themselves different every single time, and that's not me. You already took that position anyway with yours, so it's your fault. You joined first, so technically. These tricks that they were performing were not invented by them by any means. They had been done by people for years, but he was the first to think about turning these tricks into a performance for display in a specific location. The act that Philip was most famous for was The Tailor of Brentford, or Tailor's Ride to Brentford, in which he acted out a comic journey on horseback. Patty was known for her trick that consisted of her riding horseback at very fast speeds with a, quote, swarm of bees covering her hands and arms as if she was wearing a muff, end quote.
Girlfriend.
Right?
Calm
that has
down.
So much terror all around that. No, thank you.
All I could think when you were saying they were doing like horse tricks and all that stuff was Monty Python. And it's just, you can't even see like a horse. It's just some guy hitting two coconuts together.
Where did you get the coconuts?
I still haven't watched that movie.
Oh my gosh. That opening scene is the best. So many things you haven't seen. What's wrong with you? Anyway, they call the location of the stage a circle. Philip is credited with determining the best size of a circus ring at 42 feet in diameter. This was the optimum size to enable the use of centrifugal force to help balance on a horse's back. This means that he used the force of gravity to keep him on the horse's back as he rode at dizzying speeds.
Do you think he bragged about that?
A little bit. Which I can't blame him because he wasn't falling off horses anymore. So, hey, it worked.
He's probably at a party. He's bragging about it. And everybody's like, God, this guy again. We know. You made the perfect circle. Get out of here.
You're welcome, by the way. The building was called an amphitheater, but eventually the entire unit collectively became known as the circus. Note here, some believe and credit Charles Dibdin as being the first to use the term circus. Dibdin was the main competitor to Astley and was a British composer, musician, dramatist, novelist, and actor. Speaking of people that brag.
God.
On November 4th, 1782, Charles Dibdin and his partner Charles Hughes opened the Royal Circus in London, copying Astley's formula of dramatic equestrian entertainment just down the road from the riding school. So like...
Wait, they were gay back then? Openly gay? I'm just kidding.
Did you take
God.
Your medicine? Are you sure?
I did, but I took it right before.
I don't think it's kicked in yet. She took it like I watched her take it. So she just
oh, good.
Took it.
So like by the time we're done here, it'll have kicked in. Great. Awesome.
Hey, it has immediate release. There's immediate release in it. Come on, I got some okay. of it. You know, okay. there's a little
sure,
bit
sure, sure.
bouncing around in there. It's like one guy just trying
around.
To yeah,
keep everything calm.
In my head. What is happening?
Running on a hamster wheel. Why can't I go anywhere?
Why does she keep drinking coffee? Why hasn't she eaten yet?
From vam.ac.uk, quote, Astley quickly began to incorporate other acts from the fairs and pleasure gardens of London and Paris into the performance. These were acrobats, jugglers, rope dancers, clowns, and strongmen. By 1780, he had built a roof over the entire arena so that his audiences could enjoy the performances throughout the whole year.
I bet those clowns were fucking terrifying back then.
Oh, I'm sure. This was brand new, so you know they were.
Yeah, they're not great today, but back then, all I can think is that one dude, Gacy.
Oh, yeah. Well,
Gacy? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and times were different, right? They didn't have microphones, so they had to be very loud with anything that they said. Music was probably limited to whatever they could play while they were there. From what I can see, a lot of the clown type stuff at that time was mostly more like pantomime or miming because they couldn't be heard. So it just made more sense to just not try.
That would be an interesting episode, the history of clowns and how they intersect
October.
With mimes. Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. What the things. Oh, I did put it on the schedule. Things that we're terrified of. So,
yeah, that's
for October.
Clowns right up there. Joseph Grimaldi became the first mainstream clown when he performed the role of Little Clown in the pantomime The Triumph of Mirth or Harlequin's Wedding in 1781. From that same website, vam.ac.uk, quote, in 1795, Astley opened the Royal Amphitheater after his previous building had burned down. The Royal Amphitheater had a stage in addition to the circus ring, and the two were interlocked by ramps. This was an ingenious design which heightened the possibilities for tricks and dramatic effect. The audience could sit close to the ring with horses swishing past their faces as they cantered up the ramp just a few inches away. But in 1803, disaster struck again as the wooden building, lit by candles, burned down.
But it sounded like
this was a common problem, honestly.
Well, yeah.
In 1804, everything's built by wood and it's hastily erected. Let's put it that way. In 1804, Astley's Riding School was rebuilt for a third time. Each time the theater was rebuilt, the interior became more ornate. Astley also ensured that the stages were strengthened to take the weight of more horses and increase the dramatic potential of his acts. He continued to collect new acts from home and abroad, with clowns, rope walkers, and tumblers complementing the equestrian entertainment. End quote.
Do you think he just keeps burning it down to get the insurance money to make it even better the next time?
I mean, he could, but honestly, these things burning down was not uncommon.
Because
that's how they lit everything, was with candles and stoves. So it was a fire hazard, regardless of how you put it together.
Yeah, whole cities were fire hazards.
Astley's act was so popular that he was invited to perform for King Louis XV at the Fontainebleau Palace in Paris in 1771. He returned in 1774 to present his acts again and even wrote a book detailing his journey through Paris called The Modern Riding Master. In 1782, Astley built an outdoor arena for his circus in France called Palace de la République. In 1783, a permanent building was erected, and they named that the English Amphitheater, obviously because he's English, I guess, in Paris, and it makes sense.
Yeah. Good for him.
The circus continued to perform and was so successful, they were asked to perform for Queen Marie Antoinette in Versailles and King Louis XVI in 1786.
Oh, no.
Throughout this time, Astley was traveling back and forth between Paris and London, changing up the acts and performances each time. Eventually, he would build 18 more arenas throughout Europe, all in specially made buildings. And this is how the circus was done, by the way. Just FYI, actual buildings erected as they were going through towns. So
soaked in gasoline. No, those no, probably weren't.
That's the, you're, no, I don't think so. They actually wanted these to stick around for a while.
Ew. The horses in an actual enclosed building, the smell has got to be just nasty.
Probably.
Kelsey, you've been to medieval times, right?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you know how it smells like horse in there? Can you imagine that in a 1700s building with no
ventilation or no
sanitation? Yuck.
Ugh, yikes.
Yeah. Hopefully they were cleaning it pretty regularly, but I doubt it. After Astley retired in 1824, Andrew Ducrow, who was a known circus performer himself and considered the father of British circus equestrianism, took over management.
There's a lot of people who are fathers, founders, inventors of the circus going on here.
Well, it's the history of the circus, so I'm kind of highlighting those people.
I mean, I just want to put them all in a circus together and have them fight to the death, and then whoever comes out wins. Well, they're all dead already. Damn.
Well, we have AI. Maybe you can ask AI to put that together for you.
Damn, that'd be so cool.
So Ducrow had been trained from a very early age, as he was born into a circus family in Southwark, London in 1793. His father was an acrobat and strongman who was reported to be able to carry, wait for it, 5 children on a table using just his teeth. I don't really know how that makes you a strong man. It makes your teeth strong, I guess, for being able to hold all of that. But also, did anybody have good teeth back then?
Whose children? What ages are these children? Are we talking infants? Or are we talking toddlers? 10-year-olds? I mean, it makes a difference.
Difference. But even if it was 5 babies, that's still a lot for your teeth to be carrying around.
And who let this man around their children?
That's another question. They were probably volunteering because they were attending the performance. They're like, you can take my child forever.
Kelsey, let me borrow a trip. I want to try and pick up a table with him on it with my teeth.
Please don't
go for it.
He would love it.
Ducreau was known as an excellent trick rider, but also proficient as a tumbler, rope dancer, and theater actor. He appeared in Astley Circus with his act called The Flying Wardrobe, in which he would dress as a drunkard in rags and ride horseback, speeding around the ring and performing false falls and removing waistcoats until he ultimately reveals himself as the star rider of the show. This is actually now a common performance as a comic opening in many circuses today.
All I was thinking was, like, that's what I do every morning when I try to find something to wear. It's just clothes flying out of my closet. Maybe I need to get a horse.
Please don't. Just don't. Yeah, I can tell the medicine hasn't kicked in because we are not even halfway through my...
I'm sorry. Sorry, I'll shut up.
No, you won't. That's fine. I love it. The equestrian dramatic performances at Astley's were not the only thing that attendees witnessed. They also had dramatic presentations of current events and history, including news from the Napoleonic Wars, which took place between 1803 and 1815, and the Battle of Waterloo and the Battle of the Alma in 1853.
The PowerPoint.
Maybe. Who knows? No, I think it was actually more entertaining than that. Although that doesn't take very much, but neither here nor there.
Yeah, true.
Also, PowerPoint wasn't invented yet. Anyway, in 1854, William Cook produced The Crimean War as well. Unfortunately, the first night of this specific show, many actors were injured from the gunfire during the performance, even though the ammunition was supposed to be fake. Per BAMAC UK, Cook had to pay out almost as much in compensation as he had hoped to make in profits.
Ooh, womp womp. Yikes. I mean...
And that was the last thing that he tried to do. He's like, you know what? Screw this. I'm done.
I'm done with this. Yikes.
So what about America? I am so glad you asked. Because we've only been talking about Europe.
Nobody wants to know about America.
They really don't. But it is an important part of the history. Philadelphia was the home to the first modern circus in the United States and was founded by John Bill Ricketts on April 3rd, 1793. Ricketts had actually been a student of Astley's. About 800 spectators crowded in to see the new show, which included Ricketts as a trick rider, a clown, an acrobat, a rope walker, and a boy equestrian. Everyone present was enthralled by the show, including George Washington, who was reported to be in attendance. According to the Smithsonian website, quote, circuses in Europe appeared in established urban theater buildings, but Ricketts had been forced to build his own wooden arenas because American cities along the eastern seaboard had no entertainment infrastructure. Roads were so rough that Ricketts' troupe often traveled by boat. They performed for weeks at a single city to recoup the costs of construction. Fire was a constant threat due to careless smokers and wooden foot stoves, obviously. Soon facing fierce competition from other European circuses, hoping to supplant his success in America, Ricketts sailed for the Caribbean in 1800. While returning to England at the end of the season, he was lost at sea.
This is where the pirates come in.
Yeah.
Crossover sure. Episode.
Later. You'll have to figure that one out. They probably got him and they were like, oh, we heard you could do tricks. So now you get to do those on this ship for the rest of your life. Thanks. Like the circus in Europe, there was a circus that toured over many states and countries from Montreal to Havana for the first 20 years of the 19th century, building many circus buildings along the way. It was called the Circus of Pepin and Brichard. Due to the expense and therefore the need to stay in one place for so long to recoup the investment, circuses had a definite need to find a better solution. And I think this, and I put a note here, I think this came about more in America and like Latin America because of the vast nature of the terrain. There was so much space between stops and cities, and each time they stopped, they had to build something in order to do their performance. So it was really expensive. So it's hard to move from place to place to place, and they couldn't make money. If they stay there too long, they're not making as much money because people have already seen it. So
well, and then
they had to figure out a way to make that work.
At that point, too, you had the rail system in place, which made it a lot easier for them to.
Not yet.
No, not yet. You said
I'll cover that 1900s. In a minute.
Oh.
No, I didn't say 1900s. I said 19th century. That's 1800s.
Oh, God. Well, excuse me for mishearing. Damn.
Misinterpreting.
Misinterpreting. Whatever.
But what I'm saying is, like, that wasn't the case in Europe because they had a lot of buildings that they could use within city limits. So yeah, it made it a lot easier in Europe for them to be able to move place to place and make money.
Damn Europeans.
That being said, the first tent for a circus was used in 1825 by Joshua Purdy Brown, who was born in Somers, New York. This was during the Prohibition, and there were bans on public entertainment in certain cities. Brown had to find a better solution fast to outwit local authorities, so he erected a canvas pavilion circus just outside the city limits. Hey,
the father of
you
tits.
Said I couldn't do it inside of certain cities, so hey, I'll just do it right outside. But then they had to be able to tear it down if, like, word got out and they were going to be attacked or whatever, like, kicked out. They had to be able to tear it down and go.
Yeah.
Others quickly followed the suit, seeing what a perfect solution it was for their purposes. Not only was it cheaper, but because of that fact, the circus could move much quicker from city to city, frequently becoming a one-day event. And on top of that, the locals came in droves, desperate to witness entertainment provided by the troops, because they were able to also go to smaller cities. It didn't always have to be the bigger cities where they could erect an actual building.
Well, yeah, and everything was boring and bleak back then.
Yeah, please give me something to entertain me from my terrible life. No TVs. The railroad was pivotal for the expansion of the circus, and when the Transcontinental Railroad was completed in May 1869... quote, Wisconsin showman Dan Castillo took his circus, including two elephants and two camels, from Omaha to California on the new railroad, traveling seamlessly on newly...
Wait, how'd my guy get a camel over here?
Yeah, I have no idea.
What was his life?
There were boats, but I don't know how much any of that cost.
Yikes. Oh, man.
But imagine what kind of, like, people that brought to the show, because Lord knows they didn't get to see that very often.
Oh, wait. 1869. Civil War. How'd that affect? Are you going to cover that?
Mm-mm.
Okay.
Traveling seamlessly on newly standardized track and gauge, his season was immensely profitable, as you can imagine.
Yeah, people who've never even heard of a camel, like, that would... It has humps on its back? What? What is this
Why?
Creature?
It spits. Oh, that's gross.
Yeah. Giant elephants? Like, oh my God. So cool.
So I won't go into too much detail about the American circuses. Like I mentioned, I want to cover those in an episode in the future. And there's so much information in history. I may even have to cover the Ringling Brothers Circus and Barnum and Bailey each in their own episode. It'll depend on what I can pull. I will say that Barnum and Bailey was the first to introduce the idea of a freak show by hiring people from all walks of life that were unique in their own ways. This concept was also quickly picked up by others and even in Europe, thus providing jobs and a way of life to people who previously had very little options at the time. Those that traveled with the circuses also developed their own culture and honestly, a family. They often became very close and spent most of their lives together. And I hope to cover that specific aspect of circus life in detail in the future as well. It'll just depend on how much information I can get. Because there's definitely a dark side to that too, obviously.
Yeah.
And we're not going to get into it. Thomas Taplin Cook brought the tent idea to England in 1838, and tents quickly replaced the use of buildings throughout Europe as well. Followers. One of the largest, if not the largest, traveling tent circuses was the Barnum and Bailey Greatest Show on Earth, and it toured from 1897 to 1902. There were three important circus innovators around the time of 1840. Italian Giuseppe Carini, I think it's Carini. The Frenchman Louis Soleil and Jacques Tourneur, who had traveling circuses that introduced circus to Latin America, Australia, Southeast Asia, China, India, South Africa, and Russia. Carini specifically targeted locations that were the least likely to have ever seen a circus before, such as Cuba, Mexico, and South America. Soleil was the first owner to introduce Chinese acrobats to the European circus when he returned from his travels in 1866. And Tourneur was the first to introduce the performing art to Ranga, where it had become extremely popular.
Hmm.
By the mid-1800s, the circus acts had grown from mostly horseback riding and tricks to involve more and more other acts, including aquatic circus, where they filled the ring with water and performed tricks, as well as jugglers and aerial acts.
That sounds safe.
Funny you should mention that. There were some very successful circus owners, but there were also quite a few that died penniless. It's also important to remember that some of the performers would be seriously injured or even lose their lives with the dangerous stunts and tricks that they performed. One example from vam.ac.uk. Quote, Richard Sands was an American circus owner as well as an acrobat, equestrian, and ceiling walker. His Sands American Circus first visited England in 1842 with a stud of 35 horses and 25 equestrians. Sands presented his airwalking act using rubber suction pads attached to his feet at the Surrey Theatre and later at Drury Lane in 1853. In 1861, however, the stunt ended in disaster. He was challenged to walk across the ceiling of a civic building in Melrose, Massachusetts in the United States, but when a section of the plaster he was attached to gave way, he was killed by the fall.
When you said rubber suction cups at the bottom of his shoes, all I could think is, like, where did he get those? Was he ordering it from Acme? Is this like a cartoon? What is happening? That can't be real.
And apparently they worked really well because it took the plaster coming off of the freaking ceiling in order for him to fall, which,
yeah, I know.
I mean, I guess he couldn't have anticipated.
Bizarre. I need to
shoes. I'm assuming that's what made him popular because it's just like bizarre.
It's just like shoes with like a plunger head taped to them.
It's kind of actually I saw an image on some of the searches I did. That's kind of what it looked like, honestly. Not too far away.
Oh, man. That sucks he died, though. Ugh.
I feel like in a lot of ways, these performances are kind of like magicians or like NASCAR. People come to watch the performance and the tricks in the hopes that something's going to go wrong and they're going to see something different.
Oh, yeah. It's like going to a hockey game. You don't go to watch the game. You go to watch them fight.
Oh, yeah. The game is actually kind of boring, honestly. Yeah. Richard Sands is credited with introducing the type of tent we associate with circus today to England. And from what I could tell, it's like the idea of the peak in the middle with it coming down and then straight down for the walls. That's kind of the actual way his tent was. And that's what we always associate with circuses now. Before, it wasn't quite so. They weren't all the same. It was just kind of what they could put together.
Did he do the colors too? The red and white?
I tried to check to see if that was, but I couldn't see for sure if that came from him.
It was like early years.
But it makes sense.
Yeah.
Sands American Circus was advertised as having a splendid and novel pavilion made after an entirely new style. That's why I say I think it was the way that the tent actually was like peaked at the top and then you had the slopes down to the sides and then they go straight down. I think he was the one that came up with that specific design. But again, I don't know if the color scheme was also a part of it.
It's so bright and eye-catching that it would be hard to, you know, miss. So,
which I think was the point.
Yeah.
Obviously. Sands Circus toured England just 3 or 4 years and his tent was enthusiastically imitated, I'm sure, by like everyone. In 1919, Russia decided to join the fun, and the USSR nationalized Russian circuses and opened the State University of Circus and Variety Acts, better known as the Moscow Circus School, in 1927.
Hey, they try to make a school out of everything, don't they?
Why not? What is it? And that's why we drink and went to clown school.
I know. I think that's so cool. I want to meet them.
I want to know what was learned in these classes. But anyway, larger circuses would often make their arrival known by having a parade into town. One such parade by Barnum and Bailey Circus in 1899 included a menagerie, a military band, 70 horses, and a collection of, quote, living human curiosities. Apparently, during this particular parade, a 40-horse hitch, which is a wagon pulled by 40 horses, ran into a pub named the Mayflower, causing quite a lot of damage. It all worked out, though, because the publicity it created for the pub more than made up for the repair costs. Enough so that the pub owner renamed it the 40 Horse Inn.
It's just a bunch of alcoholic horses.
Yeah. They just got really excited to go to the pub.
Yeah.
It's been a really long walk. I am really tired. I really need this after a long day.
The conductor's like, damn it, I just got them all sober again. Shit. Oh, man.
Boy, their performance that night was not as good as expected at all. Another example was Sanger Circus, which had a style all its own. The typical carriage for these processions weighed about, quote, 10 tons and was drawn by 4 horses in royal state harness as part of a grand procession. All the carved woodwork on the carriage was gilded. Sanger's wife, Mill Pauline Devere, sometimes dressed as Britannia, and rode on top of the carriage holding a Union Jack shield, a gold trident, and wearing a Greek helmet. The circus lion Nero and a lamb sat together at her feet. After this came a string of camels, a herd of elephants, numerous other costumed characters, exotic animals, either in cages or led by trainers, and of course, the band. During the Second World War, the gilt on the carriage was scraped off and sold, and Sanger was forbidden by the authorities to clog up the roads with his spectacular but slow-moving processions. End quote.
This sounds like the first, like the early stages of medieval times. You got somebody who's acting as a queen on top of something being drawn by horses. Yeah, that sounds like a medieval times for sure.
It seems like they encouraged a flair for the dramatic in any and all cases possible.
Truly.
Sanger was considered the most successful circus entrepreneur of the 19th century. He was described as an eccentric millionaire, notorious for being a smart dresser, and stood out in a crowd with his shiny top hat and diamond tie pin. And that's why I wonder if that's where it came from, where we think of circus, like the ringmasters having the top hat. I wonder if it came from him, actually.
Yeah.
Because it's not really mentioned until him. So that's what I'm thinking.
One, like the snazzy outfits that they wear and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That definitely stood out.
Hell
yeah. He started a circus with his... Oh, obviously.
100%. I retire from piracy and I go into the circus business.
It makes perfect sense, honestly.
Yeah.
He started his circus with his brother in 1853, and by 1871, it had become so successful that he was able to purchase Astley's Amphitheater in London. Of course, as I think we all know, and we've briefly mentioned it, there was a vast use of exotic animals, and there was often animal abuse and much misunderstanding about how much damage they caused to these animals. They were kept in cages too small, often malnourished, and not provided clean quarters. By the turn of the 20th century, animal rights and awareness arose, and many practices were slowed and eventually stopped. Sales decreased as the public realized the treatment of these animals received, and many circuses closed, including Barnum and Bailey by the 2010s. There was a very interesting part to an article that I read in theaterinparis.com that I wanted to include because I had never heard this story, but it's actually pretty interesting. Quote, there was one clown in particular who was born in 1899 and made a name for himself in the entertainment world, a mute clown who would make the crowd laugh with his mime gimmicks consisting of silhouette performances and the imitation of objects. His name was Scaramouche Jones. If the name sounds familiar, it's probably because you've heard it in the song Bohemian Rhapsody by Queen. In 1999, after having turned 100 years old and before his last performance, Scaramouche told his tragic life story, and this is what made his name bigger than ever. He was the main talk of the 20th century for many years. His life was filled with comedy, but at the same time, he had gone through a lot of heartbreaking events. Born to a gypsy prostitute and a father who abandoned him, being sold to a snake charmer, he experienced a long journey throughout his lifetime, 100 years worth. He traveled to many places around the world, but his clown career began in a grim place, which was a concentration camp in Poland. Not all circus tales are jubilant. An electrifyingly modern bibliography of this clown story has been transformed into a one-man play entirely in English in an underground Nestle theater. End quote.
I didn't know that Scaramouche was a clown. I just thought it was gibberish that he was singing, you know?
Apparently not.
Now that I'm thinking about it, I'm like, that song makes a little bit more sense.
Every time I learn a little bit more about that song, the more sense it makes, which is really interesting because it's a lot more complex, not just the music, but the actual lyrics are actually a lot more complex than you would think without knowing all of the details.
Yeah.
Like Bismillah. I didn't know what that meant either for the longest time. Anyway, I thought that was pretty interesting.
I bet people have done dissertations on that song.
I wouldn't be surprised at all. There's so much going on. From historyofcircus.com, quote, what we call today a contemporary circus, or nouveau cirque, appeared in the 1970s in many places like Australia, Canada, France, and the west coast of the United States and the United Kingdom. This circus still has traditional acts, but combines them with theatrical techniques to tell a story or present a theme. The earliest examples of the contemporary circus are Circus Oz, formed in Australia in 1978 from Soapbox Circus and New Circus. So today, the circus that's enjoyed the most is Cirque du Soleil. It's based off the Pickle Family Circus that was started in San Francisco, California in 1971 and was a European act that appeared in France and the United Kingdom. The show was unique in that it didn't involve the use of animals and was, quote, pure fun filled with humorous acts by skilled actors. The successful circus act comprised of different stories similar to that of a play, but with special effects and acrobatic acts, end quote. Cirque du Soleil was started in Quebec, Canada in 1984. I didn't realize it was that old, to be honest, because they're a year older than me. They use special effects such as light and sound, as well as unique and colorful costumes that changed with each show. They won over crowds over the years and now have multiple shows around the country and honestly the world, and is now named the largest contemporary circus producer in the world. They have several stationary shows, and they even have several in Las Vegas alone, including Mad Apple, KAO, and Miss Deer, and Michael Jackson 1. Unfortunately, I didn't get to go to any of those because you really have to book those well in advance if you want to get into the show. Mm-hmm. But they also have several different tours that consistently bring their shows much closer to you and also provide revenue opportunities to the cities they visit. For example, when they stayed in Santa Monica, California in 2009, it was estimated that they brought in $16,700,000, which in today's dollars is $24,484,000. To the city government and local businesses. And think about it, 2009, Santa Monica was hit bad in the financial crisis. So that was probably desperately needed money. And that, my friends, is a very brief, as brief as I can make it, overview of the history of the circus.
And done. My comedic relief. Hey.
Your medicine kicked in because you started getting quiet.
Hey.
Questions, thoughts, concerns?
I'm really sad about Scaramouche. What a tragic story. I can't believe he lived to be 100 and was still performing at that time. I'm going to have to get that book about him. I want to know.
Well, I would say tragic, but also
memorable.
No, impactful, I guess I would think I would say, because I mean, he had a lot of difficult times in his life, but look at what he made out of it. And to be able to tell that story because of his fame that he got for the things that he did, more people heard that story and it made a bigger difference. So I think that's kind of what I took from it anyway.
Yeah, fair enough. I mean,
he had to have faced so many different types of prejudices over his time. Being mute and then also being
abused.
Illegitimate child, and not only illegitimate, but from, quote, gypsy prostitute. I mean, those were specifically targeted during World War II. So
I may have missed it, but was he mute by choice or like he was like deaf, couldn't talk? Like what was the...
It just said that he was mute and that's how he performed.
Oh, as okay. A mime. So probably by choice.
It could have
then.
Been by choice.
Okay. Well, if he told his life story, unless he wrote it down in the middle of a circus act, don't really know.
It said he was mute, so I'm going off of... I mean, you can... Okay. People say told as a broad term. It could have been just written out.
Yeah, I know. Just like, Well, that was...
Because obviously he wrote a biography, so.
Yeah.
Or they wrote a bibliography or whatever. But yeah, the book would be interesting to read for sure.
Yeah, I want to see if the library has it.
I want to know what he thought about Queen making a song. Because he was still, well, okay. He was around until 1999, so he was aware that he was in that song. So I wonder if that's mentioned.
When did Bohemian Rhapsody come out? It was the 70s?
That would have been the 70s, I think.
1975.
Hey. Yeah. Hey, that was a great movie, by the way.
It really was.
An actor that looked a heck of a lot like him.
And he worked hard to look like him all the time, too. Yeah. That was interesting.
That was really cool.
So, yeah, I didn't realize, honestly, that basically most circuses that we... Well, that I grew up thinking about and thinking of as the circus, almost all of them, if not all of them, are already closed because of the unethical practices and not great treatment of animals. And basically, the current circus is along the lines of Cirque du Soleil, where no animals are involved. And it's much more acrobatic performances to tell a story.
Which it should have been. But I mean, if you're going to involve animals, you can't. You can't have them traveling around in tiny cages. They need, you know, this is it. I think that there would be an ethical way to do it. You just, the logistics behind it is going to cost you way too much money. Put them in the wild where they belong or in a zoo, you know.
And I would say too, and this is not to play like devil's advocate and say that they were right in any way, shape or form. They definitely weren't. But sometimes those things that come to light are because of that treatment. So somebody worked in those circuses, saw that treatment, knew enough to know that there was something wrong to get other people involved. And if that hadn't been the case, I don't know, maybe that wouldn't have been such a big movement to try to stop it. Because it wasn't just circuses that were guilty of that. Zoos weren't taking care of their animals either.
No.
A lot of that came about, I think, from the circuses specifically, especially since they traveled to cities that normally wouldn't have a zoo that they could go to and that sort of thing. So I think things happen for a reason, I guess. And they didn't know any better. I mean, they probably knew at least a little bit of what they were doing was wrong, but they didn't know the extent. And that all came about because somebody stood up and said, yeah, this doesn't seem right. We should be doing better.
Well, that's how we got PETA.
Which can be bad too, by the way.
When I was teaching, we read an article about zoos and how they've, or not, excuse me, circuses and how they've evolved. And it was very short, but it mentioned that now, because of technology, people, you know, circuses will put like a hologram of an animal, or they'll use some sort of lighting mechanism to have animals on stage or whatever. And like drones now, I saw this thing on America's Got Talent where they were like thousands of drones, and they like shaped it into whatever they wanted it to be. Like, because we have technology now, we don't need to put real animals in quote unquote harm's way, possibly, you know, for entertainment. We have so many other options to have an animal there.
Well, drones are a really cool option. Not sure how it's going to impact our environment, you know, now, but I do know that like Disney World has moved away from, I think they've moved completely away from fireworks and they just use drones now, which is way better for the environment in itself.
I think they did that for the Olympics this year too.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
In their opening ceremony, I think they used drones for the whole big thing.
I didn't really watch a lot of the Olympics.
I mean, that's how technology is supposed to work, right? It's supposed to make us better in any way we can. And, you know, for a long time and for a lot of people, the only way they saw anything like what was in the circus was by the circus. I mean, the zoos didn't even have these animals a lot of times because they were so hard to come by and so expensive. So the circuses were the only ones that could afford to even have these animals in the first place. So,
yeah.
I also would say it also could be credited to making kids and parents more interested in animals and exotic animals and where they came from and wanting to learn about it. I mean, I know I loved looking at books like National Geographic books to see what, you know, animals, any animal one was going to be one I was going to read from cover to cover. And that's just, for a lot of people, that was the only way they ever experienced those types of animals. And to see them up close and personal was, that was unbelievable for a lot of people. So bad, but there's also good, I think, that comes of it too.
Well, I mean, that's going to be with anything in life, you know. But good job.
The job is to learn from it and move forward and do better. Be better.
This was an interesting episode. I didn't remember a lot of that stuff about circuses. So you refreshed my memory. I wonder where that
now you
is.
Need to watch The Greatest Showman because it's such a good movie. You got to watch it. I want to watch it now.
I mean, at
I
this
watched
point,
it again yesterday while I was writing the episode up.
At this point, I feel like I can't watch it just on principle, you know?
You know what, Montana? I don't want you to watch it because you'll just ruin it for me. So don't watch it.
That's fine. I do. And I don't want to startle you guys. I don't want you guys to be concerned or anything like that. But I did start watching Twilight again.
You won't watch The Greatest Showman, but you're going to watch Twilight for the 30th time. Okay. Fair enough.
Oh, no. I need to see my therapist again. Anyway, great job.
On that note.
On that note, until next time, we love you. We mean it.
Okay, bye.
The Reaper will come.